This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Now that the numbers have been crunched and the Latino vote was bigger and more influential in the 2016 presidential election, just as predicted, what in fact is the takeaway from how those communities voted? What are the most prevalent issues that immediately confront those communities of voters? And how are Latinos preparing themselves to respond to the assaults against them promised by the president-elect? Angela Falcón, president of the National Institute for Latino Policy and editor of the NILP report on Latino policy and political issues, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be with you.
I'm trying not to be overwhelmed. I'm alternating between being overwhelmed and in a kind of surreal scenario here, but must begin to come down to the earth and figure out how to deal with the enormity of the human rights, civil liberties, economic onslaughts that most of us believe is what this election portends. But why don't we begin by trying to understand the Latino vote, which was projected as so important in this election, and how did it really shake out?
Well, you know, there was a lot of hype about the Latino vote. A lot of people were talking about how you needed to have at least 40% of the Latino vote for Republicans to be elected. That was the mantra for the last, three or four elections, presidential elections. And what happened this time around is just like this election kind of like threw everybody off in terms of just being so unique in terms of the circumstances, that myth out the window in terms of that 40%. Trump won, and he got anywhere from 18 to 29% of the Latino vote. In fact, right now there's a debate within the Latino community about, you know, whether it was 18 or 29%. So there's some discussion about that. For example, here in New York City, we looked at the numbers here in New York, and we found that the Latino vote for Trump was less than 10%. So that's kind of interesting. But the Latino vote, just even though there was an increase in the number of Latino voters in Florida and in other key states, it just wasn't able to deliver the kind of margins that people thought they'd be able to deliver. And a lot of it had to do with the fact that that turned out to be more whites than we thought. So that was something that people hadn't anticipated politically.
But there was an overall increase in the number of Latino voters, right?
Yeah, well, you know, it's one of the things that, you know, we have to wait till the dust settles, because what happens, as you know, is between the midterm elections, 2012 and 2016, there are a lot more people get involved. You know, there's always an increase in the number of people that actually vote. And then the other problem we have, the other issue is to distinguish between demographic increases. In other words, the Latino population has been increasing, period. So that means that even though there may be a low level of participation in terms of rates of participation, you're going to wind up with more Latino voters. So we still have to take a closer look and see was the increase in the number of Latino voters a result of just the demographic changes, you know, the population changes, or really was it the result of the kind of mobilization that people said that they were basically undertaking? And it's been a lot of criticism within the Latino community about the fact that the Democratic Party didn't make the kind of investment in mobilizing the community and kind of waited till the last minute to kind of really reach out to the community, taking basically the Latino vote for granted.
Was it a surprise as to how many Latinos actually did back Trump? And do you have any statistical data on what groups of Latinos did in relationship to either support of Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, or for that matter, a third party?
The information we have is kind of very sketchy. Basically, what we find is that for the most part, as I said, there's a debate about whether, in terms of the overall percentage of Latinos who voted for Trump and Hillary, the feeling is that, you know, he definitely, Latinos did not, compared to Obama, Hillary did worse with Latinos, got maybe 66% of the Latino vote. And there were differences. For example, down in Florida, basically about 33% according to the same exit polls, 33% of Latinos in Florida voted for Trump, and a small majority of the Cubans down in Miami voted for Trump. So there was some kind of a difference in terms of the different Latino groups. Primarily the Latino community, over 60% probably of Latino voters are Mexican and Mexican-American. And then, you know, it's followed by maybe Puerto Ricans, and maybe like 14% of the total Latino vote. Cubans are maybe 5%. And then the rest are like a real mix of, you know, Guatemalans, Salvadorans, Colombians. So it's a very, very diverse group. But what brings them together is the fact that the vast majority are Mexican and Mexican-American.
Was it that Hillary Clinton was not popular, which depressed the vote to some extent, or were there other factors?
The thing with this this election is that there were so many factors, you know. One is Hillary Clinton was not, you know, got the vast majority of the Latino vote, but people were not that excited about her. The enthusiasm level wasn't that that high for her. And, you know, for example, right now, when I look at the demonstrations that are going on, even though they were supposedly against Trump and Trump getting elected, to me, I look at these demonstrations and these you know, what's going on, and I'm saying, hey, that probably should probably be more directed, not at Trump. It should be directed at the Democratic Party for not coming through for the constituencies supposedly that they were representing in terms of working class folks. I think that's, you know, Hillary Clinton, you know, the coronation of Hillary Clinton, I think, was a big mistake, and it's something that really, I think, even in the Latino community, kind of made people not as enthusiastic about the that part of the ticket as they could have been.
Well, since you've brought up the issue of Hillary Clinton, let's pursue that a little bit further. So President Obama had been noted as the main deporter-in-chief. This was not his positions on immigrants were extraordinarily problematic, notwithstanding DAPA, which we can talk about. Hillary Clinton was criticized severely for not going to certain prominent areas where there were more members of the working class and where there were greater Latino constituencies. I wonder if you can just flesh out for us more what those critiques should be of the Democratic Party for their response or lack thereof to the Latino constituencies.
Sure.
Who they wanted the vote from.
Well, you know, I think one of the things, a recurring theme when you talk to a lot of Latino leaders, and you know, they may not say this publicly, but something that they keep raising is the fact that they feel that the Democratic Party really takes the Latino vote for granted. And one way they indicate this is by showing the fact that when you look at the who runs the Democratic Party and who's in leadership positions, you find very few Latinos involved in any serious way in the Democratic Party, and that is reflected also in the lack of resources by the party in terms of mobilizing voters. To put it, you know, to put those kinds of the kind of resources at a certain level within the Latino community, that's an issue. I did an analysis of the transition period, you know, the whole transition process from the time that the president kind of organizes a transition team to the new administration coming in, and you know, that whole machinery that's put into place by the Obama administration for the new administration, for example. And we find that in terms of the staffing of all that entire process, you can't find any Latinos. So what you see that is in the day-to-day machinations of the Democratic Party, its leadership, in terms of the way it operates, Latinos are very much outside, continue to be outsiders, and their vote continues to be taken for granted. Same case with, obviously, someone like Hillary Clinton, who really basically does, you know, is represents that type of attitude towards the Latino community.
There's speculation by Bernie Sanders and also by Chuck Schumer that Keith Ellison, who's co-chair of the Progressive Caucus, should be the new DNC chair. Would that be a step forward?
You know what's interesting? My reaction to the discussion that's going on now is that I get the feeling that the Democratic Party is not taking this debacle seriously enough, and they are trying to basically deal with this issue as kind of like, business as usual in a top-down kind of way. I think they need to begin to look at this issue from the bottom up and start talking about mobilizing their constituency in a different way and developing a discussion and a debate within the Democratic Party from the grassroots up, not from the top down. This idea of, Howard Dean or whoever, that to me is basically their attempt to kind of act as if this is business as usual, when in fact this is a major crisis, I think, for the Democratic Party.
I'm loath to. I want to, in some ways, turn to the impact of Trump's rhetoric on different groups within the Latino community. But I guess I'm going to dwell for a moment longer on the Democratic Party. So what needs to be done that the Democratic Party didn't do, as it takes for granted certainly the votes of organized labor, which, of course, organized labor certainly never put enough pressure on them to
right.
take more aggressive stance on their behalf in terms of they certainly didn't get, and I don't think Bernie Sanders really got, also Black Lives Matter, if you will, and the Latino community is another one. We can also say that for almost any of the oppressed communities. And the community, for that matter, of poor people, which
right.
the Democratic Party really said very little about.
Right.
And here they were professing a great interest in feminism, and yet the people who are the poorest in this country are women and children.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there wasn't a bleeping word, a mumbling word about social services, about public assistance, about the dismantling of
yeah.
the safety net by, indeed, Bill Clinton. So your thoughts on what the commentary should be towards, or our protest
yeah.
should be, not forgetting the Democratic Party, who I guess thinks it can kind of coast off of the onslaught from people of good
right.
conscience against Trump.
Well, I think the big problem to me with the Democratic Party, and there are many people who don't believe the Democratic Party is really the right vehicle for any real social change in society, but if you stick with the Democratic Party in terms of what they should be doing, right now they should recognize that they're in a major political crisis, and they need to do things in a very different way. But I would, within the Latino community, for example, I would put the onus in terms of making any changes in terms of the Democratic Party on Latino political leadership, those Democrats that are in elected office, that are supposed to be party leaders and should be leading the charge in terms of putting pressure on that party to open up and to be more responsive and to make sure that platform that supposedly Bernie Sanders shoved to the left a little bit actually becomes a real document, the real organizing tool. So I think
would that be Luis Gutierrez as well?
Well, I think it's got to be people like Luis Gutierrez. There's a whole bunch of players in the Latino community that I think need to play a much stronger role. I'm not sure. It may be possible, unfortunately, that maybe it doesn't exist. Maybe these people don't exist because it's a recurring issue. In the Latino community, you hear people saying things like, we need a Latino Al Sharpton type of person. You hear that a lot in terms of the fact that within the Latino community, sometimes it's hard to identify certain key leaders that are kind of mobilizing the community at the national level. So we have a lot of work to do within the Latino community itself. And right now the most energetic part, I think, politically of the Latino community has been around the issue of immigrant rights and immigrants. And ironically, it's been the undocumented that have been taking the lead in a lot of the mobilization. And one of the results of that, for example, is that the Latino issues become almost totally identified with immigration, when there are other issues having to do with employment, health, housing, that really don't kind of rise to the top of the agenda. So there's a lot of work that has to be done within the Latino community. And right now, we're on the defensive. Over a quarter of the Latino population is undocumented, and so right now, as a lot of immigrant rights groups are basically trying to let their people know, look, to be careful in terms of their legal rights, in terms of basically trying to protect people from all sorts of racist kinds of actions and hate speech. So, very much right now on the defensive and trying to develop that kind of response, and then trying to figure out how to deal with the two-faced faces of Donald Trump. I mean, you know, you have the Trump, the campaigner, with saying all sorts of horrible things, attacking people, creating all sorts of havoc in the society. And now you have the new Trump, the governing Trump, who's trying to present themselves as some sort of kind of reasonable guy, trying to make sense of that transition between campaigning and governing. Is going to be interesting to see how that kind of works itself out.
Well, Trump is now saying that most of the undocumented are terrific people, except for the 2 or 3 million thugs that he wants to deport right when he gets into office.
And then you begin to see those kinds of shifting, a little bit of shifting in terms of the way he's approaching it, because, quite frankly, a lot of things that he's proposing are just not doable. I mean, in terms of the kind of you know, money you're talking about, the kind of disruptions it's going to create. But certainly, you know, his program in terms of talking about getting rid of deporting criminals, well, quite frankly, that's very much what Obama's been saying as well.
Yeah, but he never said 2 or 3 million people.
Well,
are
I think
criminals.
You know, Trump just kind of makes things up. I mean, in terms of that's based on like nothing. It's based on him just throwing out some numbers. So it's not that large a group. But again, you know, he just throws these things out. And as usual, the media doesn't question him. They just basically repeat it. That's it.
And those people, those terrific people that he's going to keep, are they going to be living in fear?
Well,
that's
a problem. And the issue, it's almost like, you know, he's basically setting up kind of a deserving versus undeserving, you know, undocumented kind of situation. And I don't know. Yeah, I mean, it's going to be as it develops, it'll be interesting to see how it kind of works itself out, because we're not sure exactly how Trump is going to be dealing with that issue, and how the Republicans, who, you know, at this point we thought we were going to be talking about how the Republican Party was going to be totally falling apart, and now it looks like they're stronger than ever, you know. So it'll be interesting to see how they assert their own conservative politics around these issues with Trump. It's going to be really interesting to see how that kind of works itself out.
Yeah, I'm not sure that Steve Bannon doesn't eat his young, but that remains to be seen, not to mention Jeff Sessions, Rudy Giuliani, and
it's crazy.
Newt Gingrich. I thought we had defeated each one of them in succession.
Well, it's crazy. He's like trying to make sense of where this is going, you know, and the craziest part is to see Trump acting so reasonably, you know, with 60 Minutes, and you go, wait a minute, what's going on here? It's like the guy's like a schizophrenic, you know.
I would differ with you a little bit. In between the lines there, he did quite a number on women and abortion and stuff. So, you know, tweet with one finger, twit with the other, you know.
Yeah.
But, of course, there's the issues of the Cuban embargo. There's the issues of PROMESA in
Puerto Rico. Yep.
There's the issue that the Latino community writ large said was of dominant importance to itself, and that was the issues of education. In the very little time that we have, we will see how these issues shake out. But it seems that I would take the rhetoric quite seriously, because this is a country that's fault line is xenophobia and racism. And that's clearly, I think, the dominant appeal of the Trump administration to the white working class who voted for him. So where do you see going in terms of the unanimity or bringing together the different groupings, you know, from Latin America, from Puerto Rico, from Cuba, etc., the different groups of Latinos to form, is it possible, a united front against the very serious potential threats of the Trump administration to their fundamental rights?
Well, there are efforts already, you know, basically on the way. There's a group in Washington called the National Hispanic Leadership Agenda, which is a coalition of like 40 of the larger Latino civil rights organizations that are right now trying to figure out how to basically organize themselves around this issue. As I mentioned, the immigrant rights groups are organizing demonstrations and organizing all over the place, and we need to find a better way to connect the immigration issues with these other issues in the Latino community. There's a question of what we're going to be doing, as you mentioned, with Puerto Rico, which is 3.5 million U.S. citizens out there that are in a whole different ballgame in terms of, you know, massive debt crisis that they have down there. And there are issues there, for example, for a political prisoner, Oscar Lopez Rivera, that people are concerned about. Will the president pardon him before he leaves office? which is another kind of issue in terms of how people look at the movement in Puerto Rico for independence. So there's a lot of stuff on our plates, and the question, again, is if anything that Trump did is, I think he raised the stakes in terms of politics in New York, in the United States. And to see young, little 10-year-old kids talking about politics and the election really has just raised the stakes. So the hope is that in raising the stakes that we have a greater amount of activism. And I think, as you're saying, we need to also look at the politics with a very critical eye in this administration because there's some really, really very, very evil people behind and besides, you know, Trump. And it'll be interesting to see how they develop their plans and how we basically can organize, kind of counter whatever they're going to be doing in terms of hurting the most vulnerable people in society.
We've been speaking to Angelo Falcone, president of the National Institute for Latino Policy, and he's going to be with us many times after this because we have mountains to climb before we can rest, and we are such that we really need to prepare. I wouldn't say think the worst and, well, yes, I would. Think the worst and prepare for the best. And that rests with us. It's always the people and the masses of people who have brought systems to its knees, who have effectuated change. And there's no reason that we won't accomplish that and move to a much more humane and thoughtful society. Thank you so much for joining us, Angelo.
Oh, thank you for having me.
¿Qué queremos? ¿Qué queremos?
Immigrant community activists in Los Angeles have mobilized with a message for the new president-elect.
We don't hate you. We respect you. We don't hate you, but we don't fear you either.
Fearlessness is what drove these laborers to defend their place in society.
We know that this country depends on the labor of immigrants.
They just want to be treated equal, and they also want to be included in this economy as well.
California is home to over 10 million immigrants, many of whom assume day labor jobs, from plumbing to gardening to farming.
Immigrants say without their labor, these businesses would never succeed.
That's kind of been the talk of who's going to be doing that work if a lot of our folks get deported.
According to political analysis website 538, immigrants are more likely to start businesses and participate in the labor force than Americans.
They are what has built this community and is the future of this economy.
But right now, the future is uncertain. That's in part because Trump has said he will deport millions of illegal immigrants. These activists have another proposal for Trump.
If Mr. Donald Trump wants to make this country great, he has to respect these hands, because these are the hands that built this country.
Respect will continue to be a theme for community activists when they host what they're calling a popular assembly next week. For Annenberg Media, I'm Gabriella Vidal.
Welcome back to the news here on RT America. Anti-Trump demonstrations continued across the country. Today, student protesters marched on the streets of Los Angeles, Oakland, and Baltimore. Thousands of protesters gathered in other major cities, including New York City, marking the fifth consecutive day of demonstrations since Trump was named president-elect. RT's Trinity Chavez is in New York with the latest tonight.
Thousands of people are still outraged at Donald Trump winning the presidential election, a message they are taking right to his doorstep.
Donald Trump, go away! Racist, sexist, anti-gay!
Demonstrators are upset about Trump's policies on health care and the environment. Many are concerned the president-elect will take away rights of women, minorities, and those a part of the lesbian gay community.
If we don't support him, we don't support racism, sexism, or homophobia.
I want him to know, personally, that I may have to accept him as president, but I really don't like what he stands for.
Some are even questioning the legitimacy of Trump's victory over Hillary Clinton, since Clinton did win the popular vote.
I don't believe in the Electoral College. I believe more in the popular vote. But, I mean, obviously it wasn't a turnout. It wasn't a good turnout this year, for one thing. And I think it doesn't represent the view of most Americans.
But they aren't the only ones trying to get their message heard. Calvin Hunt says that he's been with Trump since day one.
And a lot of people say things, a lot of people do things, but at the end of the day, we got to see what kind of job he's going to do. You know, I know he said a lot of wicked things, and I scratch my head a lot of days. wondering what's going to come out next out of Trump, but within the last 24 hours, it's sort of like he's angelic. Because now he knows that it's no longer a game. This is not The Apprentice. He's not going to see Dennis Rodman no more. It's time to get down to business. So if people give him a chance, I think this might be one of the best presidents we've ever seen.
Since Election Day, many have gone as far as expressing fears of bigotry and racial violence against minorities following incidents of harassment and hate crimes. But in a CBS 60-minute interview, Trump told his supporters to stop the harassment.
They don't do it. That's terrible. Because I'm going to bring this country together.
They're harassing Latinos, Muslims.
I am so saddened to hear that. And I say, stop it. If it helps, I will say this, and I'll say it right to the camera, stop it.
Although the demonstrators know that they can't do anything to reverse the outcome of this presidential election, they still want to get their message out and plan to protest as long as they can. Reporting in front of Trump Tower in New York City, Trinity Chavez, RT.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.